in order to pay my respects to people who are probably from a physics background, I will motivate the essence of the talk by some comments on quantum physics. Indeed, this is, in essence, the motivation of the theme which I call quantum metabolism. As you know, quantum mechanics began with the attempt to explain this famous Stefan Boltzmann law, where E is the energy density of radiation and T is the temperature. And in 1900, Planck solved it. And his key insight was the notion that radiation oscillators can be quantized. You're all familiar with that. So this empirical law is a relationship between temperature and the energy density of radiation. The next, you may say, historical development in these ideas was, I think, about 1912. And there were two classes of empirical laws. This is Stefan Boltzmann, and the next class is by Dulong and Pitching. And here, the empirical law relates specific heat with temperature. And the observation is that specific heat is linearly related to temperature for systems with high, a solid with high temperature, and it relates, it scales with temperature to the power of 3 in the low temperature regime. And as you all know, I think it's about 1915, these empirical rules were explained by Einstein and Debye. Einstein gave the first model for this. And the explanation rests on the idea of quantization of material oscillators. Yes.
Could that possibly be that in the high temperature regime, the specific heat is a constant, and the energy is linear with temperature?
No, I think in the high temperature regime, with specific heat, I think you're right. The specific heat is just KB, it's just a constant. And in the low temperature regime, the specific heat is T to the cube. Thanks. So this was perhaps the first critical development of Planck's idea. And their model was to think of a solid, crystalline solid, the atoms which are embedded in these crystalline solids. Energy is stored by the vibrations, and the vibrations are quantized. So in biology, about 1940, and this is the topic I want to discuss this talk. There exists a certain class of scaling relations. They do not involve temperature, because temperature doesn't play critical role in biological systems. They involve what is called cycotype, which is the turnover time of certain metabolites. Kleiber, which is a German physiologist, observed that metabolic rate P scales to body size as 3/4 for animals, and cycle time scales to 1/4 if we look at animals. So we can say that metabolic rate scales with cycle time to the power of 3 for animal organisms. And one might ask whether one can account for this kind of empirical relation in terms of some molecular mechanism. The thrust of my talk is to show that by extending the Debye model, which is the foundation for the quantum theory of solids, one can provide a molecular explanation for this biological principle. In essence, one is replacing temperature by cycle time and peak capacity by metabolic rate.
Excuse me, what is the dimension of metabolic rate? Is
it energy per time. And the thrust of my talk will try to give you the mathematical ideas that underlies this. If I presented a purely mathematical talk, we'd just proceed in this direction. I don't want to do that. I want to take a different angle. Since these rules have their basis in some really fundamental biological processes, I will begin by giving you some perspective regarding the biology that underlies it. This is a group of physicists. I think appreciating the biology would indeed be educational in the first place. And then I want to indicate how, by what I call quantization of molecular oscillators, one can make sense of this empirical rule. So that's my comment to the physicist here. This piece of technology, let us, okay. So that's the title of my talk. And the term allometric scaling relations in biology pertain to these types of relations. Some vocabulary. I'll be talking about physiological time. And physiological time refers to 3 items. There are many others, but these are the critical ones. Respiratory cycle, the cardiac cycle is just the time of a heartbeat. Maximum lifespan is the lifespan of a species or an organism. Metabolic rate, that's the rate of energy expenditure. And there are three types of metabolic rate which are involved in these studies. There's the basal metabolic rate, which is the rate which occurs when you just sit and do nothing. Sit on an empty stomach, because if you have just had a meal, there is a lot of active metabolic processes that are going on, which will indeed affect your rate. Maximal metabolic rate pertains to the rate which occurs when the organism is active, running a treadmill or running 100 meters. And field metabolic rate is the rate of energy expenditure when the organism is running about doing its normal activity. And these are quite different. And body size, you know what that is. It's a little more difficult to define for plants because it's a lot of dead wood. With animals, there's less. So the body size in animals is much more standardized. What I will be discussing as far as the empirical rules are concerned is the basal or the standard metabolic rate. And these rules apply to the basal rate. Now, here are the empirical facts. Y is physiological time, W is body size. And over the past 100 years, a lot of data has accumulated relating these two quantities. Physiological time varies between a quarter and a third. And the proportionality constant tends to be much larger for birds than for mammals. The standard metabolic rate, this exponent, varies between two-thirds and one. And for annual plants, it's about two-thirds, and for perennial plants, it's one. And for animals, for small animals, it's about two-thirds. And for large animals, it's three-quarters. And endotherms are warm-blooded organisms, ectotherms are cold-blooded organisms like lizards. And the empirical observation is that for endotherms is bigger than that. It's large for endotherms and much smaller for ectotherms. Question?
Again, back to the question that was asked before, units. And then what units are?
Well, I'll come back to that. Mm-hmm. The next slide will make that clear.
What alpha?
Not this one, but the other. Mm-hmm. The structure of my talk is to give you the historical origins behind this. I'll then come to what I call quantum metabolism, which I propose is just an extension of the metabolism of material, the study of material oscillators to explain these rules. And thirdly, I'll describe a class of models which I call directionality theory, which will explain why certain plants have exponents two-thirds, and certain other, say, annual plants have exponent two-thirds, and perennial plants have exponent one. So, item number two, you may understand it as giving approximate explanation of these rules. And item three, which I call directionality theory, provides an evolutionary explanation for these rules. Now, what are the historical origins of this? Laplace and Lavoisier were the first people, were the first scientists to be interested in this. If you're a chemist, Lavoisier is considered the father of chemistry, and Laplace, if you're a mathematician, he comes up into Laplacian. They got together to study a rather curious problem. Is there a relationship between metabolic rate and size? And they did a rather primitive experiment. They placed a guinea pig in a calorimeter. And measured its metabolic rate by the amount of ice melted over a certain time. And they observed that this metabolic rate varied with the size of the organism. The whole situation didn't go much further. I think Laplace was really interested in the flow of heat. In fact, he developed several models to explain that. And Lavoisier was interested in oxygen, as you know. It's rather curious why they got together to do this very, very down-to-earth experiment. Yes?
I'm assuming that the experiments have become more sophisticated since then.
Yes.
When you stick a guinea pig on a block of ice, because it's an endothermic animal, its metabolic rate will increase.
It's
metabolic rate will slow down.
It wasn't stuck on a block. Ice. He was placed in a particular machine, and it was quite extravagant for that period. Things have improved considerably since then. And Rubner, a German physiologist, revisited this whole class of problems, and he used domesticated animals, dogs, cats, pigs also. And he was the first person to recognize quantitatively that there exists certain relationships between size and metabolic rate. He also went further and realized that body size is related to lifespan. It was Kleiber in 1940 who made the first systematic study of this issue. And Kleiber looked at a whole group of organisms, both domesticated and non-domesticated. And he introduced a certain sophistication into this problem by doing some sort of statistical analysis to see whether it's two-thirds or three-quarters. And we owe a lot to Kleiber, who summarized his studies in a book which he called The Fire of Life. This is specifically the class of rules which have emerged. And these are the units. If we look at physiological time as a function of body size, we see that the scaling exponent is, roughly speaking, between a third and a quarter. And this is true whether you're looking at maximum lifespan, the cardiac cycle, or the respiratory cycle. And you'll observe that in birds, the proportionality constant is much larger than in mammals. And this is true for all measures of physiological time. If we look at metabolic rate, we see a similar pattern. If we look at the basal rate and compare ectotherms with homeotherms, we also see that the range beta lies between two-thirds and three-quarters. If you look at plants, it goes to 1, and with unicellular organisms, it ranges from 2/3 to 3/4. There are some generalizations which we can draw from those patterns. The first is birds live longer than mammals of similar body size. And you can see this just by looking at the maximal lifespan. A rat and pigeon of about the same size, but pigeons have a maximal lifespan of about 35 years, whereas a rat has a lifespan of about 4 years. And this is true when you make comparison between birds and mammals. And this is very, very important because there's a lot of interest now in trying to extend human lifespan. The feeling is that if you understood why birds have such a long lifespan for their body size, it may be able to mimic this in humans and extend human lifespan.
Do you know the lifespan of an ostrich?
No, not. Is it not compared to us? Yes. And what's its? I see. Humans are extraordinary in this sense. In this lineage, humans have extraordinarily long lifespan. Humans are very, very particular kind of mammals. So the kind of generalizations which emerge are that birds live longer than mammals, homotherms have larger metabolic rate than ectotherms, and larger mammals have higher scaling exponent than smaller mammals. So these are interesting facts, and it's biology is unusual in the sense that it's real. You have a class of empirical rules which have a strong quantitative component. The issues that I want to discuss are, what is the mechanistic basis for these rules? Why is the proportionality constant in birds so much larger than the proportionality exponent for mammals? And why do you get this variation in scaling exponents between perennial plants and annual plants and large mammals and small birds? The theory which I want to propose, which accounts to this, as I said, is called quantum metabolism. And it puts together three classes of phenomena. The first, if you're a chemist, this number one would be familiar, it's called the chemiosmotic coupling between electron transfer and ADP phosphorylation. The second, which is perhaps closer to the thinking of a physicist, postulates that the storage of the metabolic energy is in the vibrational modes among the molecular components of the membrane. And the third element which occurs in the model is that the quantization of the energy is actually that energy stored in the membrane is quantized. And to jump ahead, the models in quantum solid state physics, which tries to understand the relationship between specific heat and the temperature, postulates that the specific heat is due to the vibrational energy of the atoms which are embedded in the solid. And here we are postulating that the metabolic energy is due to the vibrational energy of the proteins, which are now embedded in the energy transducing membrane of the cell. The parameters which occur in this model are, first, proton conductance, which is the conductance of protons across the mitochondrial membrane. The basic element of the basic construct in this model is the mitochondria or the chloroplast and the energy transducing membrane in these systems. And these energy transducing membranes actually play the role of a crystalline solid. And the proteins embedded in these energy transducing membranes will play the role of the atoms which are embedded in these crystalline solids. And concepts such as the proton conductance or the proton motive force are just thermodynamic or bioenergetic variables which describe the resistivity of the membrane and the potential difference across the membrane. The second class of concepts which arise are the thermodynamic efficiency or the metabolic efficiency, which is the rate of ADP phosphorylation to the rate of electron transport. See, all the energy which we actually use comes from the dynamics of the electron transport chain. And the third class of parameters relate primarily macroscopic parameters. They relate to the efficiency with which energy is transported between the different cells and tissues of the organism. These are the results of the model, and these are the results which I intend to explain. The model predicts that metabolic rate P scales with body size to the exponent beta, and the proportionality constants are functions of just two primary parameters, the proton conductance C and the voltage across the membrane delta P. The second equation relates maximum lifespan with body size. And it says that maximum lifespan, if you just forget about the terms mu or theta, is inversely related to the proton conductance. So it's important to recognize that quantities like, it's important to appreciate the importance of proton conductance and the proton motive force in these equations. Equation 2 simply says that differences in maximum lifespan of two species is determined primarily by the proton conductance C. And birds will live much longer than mammals of the same size because of differences in the structure and function of their mitochondrial membrane. So the model makes very, very explicit predictions. It says if I know body size and I know the proton conductance and I know things like mu and theta, I can predict maximum lifespan. I would give you in the next half an hour the mathematical ideas that underlie those two results and give you some examples of the interpretations you can extract from them. First of all, let me comment on their implications. One empirical fact is that proton conductance is greater in endothermal tissues than in homologous tissues of ectotherms. Proton conductance, remember, a mitochondrial membrane is constructed out of what are called phospholipid components. And the proton conductance is a function of these phospholipid components. They differ between birds and mammals. They differ between ectotherms and ectotherms. And we predict that from this empirical observation that endotherms will have larger metabolic rate than ectotherms of the same body size. The second prediction which emerges from the model rests on the fact that proton conductance is smaller in tissues of birds than in tissues of mammals. We can therefore predict from this model that birds will have a longer lifespan than mammals of the same size. Yes?
Don't you have the same two predictions for both cases? I mean, don't you also have the prediction in terms of lifespan between endotherms?
Well, yes. We do have such a prediction. There's a slight difference in that we can say the same thing about lifespan for endotherms, but the differences are much more dramatic when you compare birds and mammals. There seem to be many, many other factors which are implicated in determining the lifespan of ectotherms, things like temperature. And that also is, if we go back to the equation, the lifespan depends not just on the proton conductance, it depends on parameters like mu and theta, which I didn't really want to comment on. These will vary tremendously between ectotherms and endotherms. With birds and mammals, they remain relatively the same. So the lifespan, if we want to compare birds and mammals, will be determined primarily by the proton conductance, given that the body size is the same. Now, let me give you the ideas behind the model. I think of a membrane, and all the metabolic activity occurs in the membrane. This is a typical mitochondrial membrane, and the proteins are sort of stacked in these membranes. And then the intuition one has in mind is that these proteins will play the same role as atoms which are embedded in a crystalline solid. There is evidence that these proteins which are embedded in the membrane do vibrate. And the vibration or the degree of oscillation depends very much on the energy which is being transduced in the membrane. The model puts together these ideas, which I've already mentioned. The first is the coupling of the electron transport. That idea goes back to Mitchell. The second idea is energy storage. That idea goes back to a physicist called Froelich, who was the first is a quantum physicist who tried indeed to apply quantum solid state physics to biological systems. However, he did that at a time when one wasn't at all aware of the chemosmotic theory. And the third item is the energy quantization hypothesis. So the third item says that the molecular oscillations embedded in the energy transducing membranes are quantized. In the Debye model, one assumes quantization of the material oscillators of these atoms. In this model, I assume quantization of the molecular oscillators. That's a critical difference. There is another critical difference, and we'll see this as we proceed. In the chemiosmotic model, energy transduction involves really three processes. Perhaps this will make the whole picture clearer. There's high energy electrons which are being transformed into low energy electrons by some proton circuit. And one can, if one knows the proton motive force and the proton conductance of the membrane, determine the energy generated per cycle. And the energy generated per cycle, this is in essence a kind of Ohm's law, is going to depend on the product of the proton conductance and the proton motive force. And this expression E equal G tau will play a very critical role in the development of this model. This simply recapitulates what I said originally. It says that the membrane is the critical object in these models, and there are empirical evidence for that. About 1972, Singer and Nicholson studied the membranes very carefully and observed that membranes are not some fluid structure as was previously thought. They are indeed very strongly integrated non-covalent aggregates. And the second element in the model is that the proteins embedded in the phospholipid layer undergo collective modes of vibration due to the energy fed into the system from the reaction. And that is, in essence, Fourier's idea. Now, if we now assume that the energy generated by the electron transfer process per cycle is E equals G tau, and if you assume that the energy is quantized, then one can establish that the metabolic energy transduced in the membrane has that particular form, which seems very, very much like the form which is obtained in the Debye model. The critical difference is that instead of KBT, which is the thermal energy, you now have G tau, which is the metabolic energy per cycle. And one can evaluate the total metabolic energy, assuming that you have a certain set of characteristic frequencies. One can approximate this discrete sum by integrating over a density of states. And one obtains an expression which is formally identical to the expression which you observe in the formula for the heat energy in the Debye model. So if you postulate a characteristic cycle time, then one can show that for large cycle time limit, the energy generated is going to be proportional to G tau, where N is the total number of proteins embedded in the membrane. And in the small cycle time limit, the energy generated is going to be proportional to tau to the fourth. And for people familiar with solid state physics, it should be obvious, everything to them, that this is very, very similar to the expressions for the heat energy in a crystalline solid. And one might ask, how can one legitimize this? Let me give you the idea behind it. In solid state physics, one is interested in concepts like free energy and temperature and classical thermodynamic energy, thermodynamic entropy. And we know that the free energy satisfies the variational principle. It's the infimum of the mean energy minus the temperature times the entropy. And at equilibrium, F equals E minus ST. If you now look at the metabolic reaction, which you could express by a dynamical system of the form UT plus 1 equals AT UT, and you write down the flux rate of this process, then one can actually prove that the flux rate in the metabolic networks also satisfies the variational principle. The entropy, which I call H mu tau, is quite different from the Gibbs-Boltzmann thermodynamic entropy. It's an entropy rate. And the phi d mu is some energy averaged over the phase space of the system. From this variational principle, one can infer that the flux rate is satisfies the relation, the identity H T tilde plus phi, where phi is the metabolic energy, H is some entropy production rate, and T tilde is the cycle time. This mathematical result enables us to contrast or to develop a kind of table which relates thermodynamic variables and metabolic parameters. It establishes that in the thermodynamic system, say the Debye model, the free energy is going to correspond to the metabolic flux. The temperature will correspond to the cycle time. The heat capacity will be analogous to the metabolic rate. The thermodynamic entropy is analogous to the entropy production rate. And as you very well know, in the quantum theory of solids, it's the thermal energy per mole which plays the critical role, kBT. In these metabolic models, it's now G tau, the energy generated per cycle. And this, one might call this mathematical digression, was introduced simply to justify the application of this quantum formalism, which was developed simply for understanding the relationship between heat capacity and temperature, to a biological system where temperature does not play a critical role. In most biological systems, things, all the metabolic processes occur at a constant temperature. And the flow of energy is driven by differences in cycle time, not differences in temperature. It's a purely non-equilibrium system. And what we are doing in this context is developing a formalism which mimics this equilibrium situation where temperature is the critical parameter, to another class of models where time or cycle time is the critical parameter. And by pushing that formalism to its limit, you obtain relations which are very analogous to the relations in the solid state model. And this is the reason why I began with a preamble. You see, the first model which Planck introduced was to understand the relationship between the energy density of radiation with temperature, and it's T to the fourth. Then Einstein and Debye had the insight to recognize that the whole formalism hinges on the quantization of these radiation oscillators. The Dulong-Petit relations are relationships between specific heat and temperature. They look very much like the Stefan Boltzmann law. They made the leap that by quantizing the material oscillators, we should be able to generate these relations. Alas, when you did the computation, you obtain these. And that has blossomed into solid state physics. The insight in this class of situations comes from the observation that the empirical rules are very similar. The difference is in the parametrization. In one case you have temperature, in the other case you have cycle time. If you could justify the correspondence between cycle time and temperature, you could legitimize invoking that formalism to study the relationship between metabolic rate and cycle time. And this is what we've carried out. However, to proceed in that direction, we need an assumption. The assumption is the quantization of molecular oscillators. The molecules in these cases are proteins. And once we do that, we derive these relations, and we now have the whole body of literature of quantum solid state physics to guide us in developing this formalism.
So there is no related classical theory or attempted classical explanation?
Well, there's a classical explanation in the sense that when the specific heat is just a constant, you are in the classical range, you see. Let us go back to this model. When tau is much bigger than tau star, in the quantum solid state physics, tau is much bigger than the Debye theta d. You have the classical range and things are linear. Things only become quantized when tau is very small. And this is why you get these two expressions for the specific heat. You don't see this in the radiation formalism. You just get T to the fourth because there is no classical description. It's quantized all the way. But in the quantum theory of solids, you can obtain a classical description or a quantized description depending simply on the temperature. In these models, what drives it is the dependency on the cyclic. So this more or less just recapitulates what I said, that in the classical situation, the cycle time is just 1 over g. It just depends on the parameters that describe the proton conductance and the proton motive force of the membrane. And the metabolic rate, that should be equal, is just linear with body size. Whereas in that range, things become quantized. Things become quantized because the metabolic energy, in this case, is much less than the vibrational spacing of the proteins. So you end up with a quantized situation, and you get a scaling load. So we can make some predictions from this, that proton conductance, the parameter C, G is just the product of C and delta P. Proton conductance is a critical determinant of metabolic rate. And because of the differences in proton conductance between ectotherms and endotherms, we can make predictions about the metabolic rate of endotherms and ectotherms. Because of the differences in proton conductance in large and smaller mammals, we can make predictions about the metabolic rate of large and small mammals. We can also make statements about maximum lifespan. The maximum lifespan for animals, for plants is much more complicated. It's going to be the proton motive force times the cycle time. And this predicts that maximum lifespan, there should be some proportionality constant here, is inversely related to the proton conductance for a fixed body size. And since energy transducing membranes in birds have smaller proton conductance than homologous membranes in mammals, then you predict birds have a longer lifespan than mammals of similar body size. This particular equation is of some interest to gerontologists, since there is at the moment considerable concern in modulating lifespan by physiological intervention. One physiological intervention is reducing caloric intake or being ingested with particular drugs. It is thought that, for example, reducing the caloric intake of mice will increase their metabolic rate by increase their lifespan by 40% if you reduce the caloric intake by 20 or 30%. And one can ask the question whether such an intervention would work for humans. This kind of analytical result provide insights into these issues, since it says that the lifespan depends very much on the proton conductance. And in order to manipulate the lifespan, you need physiological factors which will have some effect on the composition, the phospholipid composition of these membranes. And one can predict, and then actually written on this and got a lot of criticism from the caloric restriction society. My prediction is that caloric reduction in healthy organisms, at least in humans, will have very little effect on extending your lifespan. And that is an interesting fact which emerges from this theory. What the kind of changes which we observe in mice, C. elegans, and low organisms are not possible in humans. So that's an interesting result from this analysis, which indeed suggests that it's not just an empty formalism. It has quite striking implications.
Why do the empty transducing membranes in birds have a smaller proton conductance? What is it that's different about the biochemistry of birds compared to mammals that allows them to get away with having a lower proton conductance? Do they use their calories more or less efficiently, or?
There are evolutionary reasons for that, and I will come to that. There are evolutionary reasons why, for example, you can manipulate mice and by caloric restriction regimes and increase their lifespan by 40%, and you can't do that for humans. Even if a human were to allow this particular kind of intervention. And the evolutionary reasons will be made clear in the next few minutes. So this is the formula for the metabolic rate, and we have for the beta exponent depends on whether you are in the classical regime or in the quantum regime. The beta exponent tends to be large if you're in the classical regime, it tends to be small if you're in the classical regime. To come to the point you raised, one might ask, what is the basis for this variation in scaling exponents? Why, for example, would large animals have a large beta and smaller animals have a small beta? Why would perennial plants have beta equals 1 and annual plants have a small beta? To address this issue, mention this in a few minutes. I need another kind of theory. Quantum metabolism, one may call, provides proximate mechanisms to account for beta and alpha, where beta is a scaling exponent and alpha is the proportionality constant. If we want to find adaptive explanations, we need a new class of models. We want to understand why do birds have that particular characteristic about their membrane and mammals, a different characteristic. We need to ask what are the ecological forces that modulate the evolution of birds and mammals. Whatever membrane structure we now have, structures which we have in some sense inherited over evolutionary time and that have enabled us to function effectively under particular kinds of ecological constraints. And this class of models gives you some insight into this. The central concept in these models is a concept which I call evolutionary entropy. It's very simple to explain this. That's the model of a population of organisms. You split up this population into DH classes. The transition 1 to 2, B1 is just the proportion that survives from H class 1 to 2. B2 is the proportion that survives from H class 2 to 3, and so on. The arrow from 2 to 3 I've weighted that by N2, is the mean number of offspring produced by individuals in each class 2. And ND is the mean number of offspring produced by individuals in each class B. So the parameters in this model are the survivorship to each class J and the net offspring production at each class J. VJ is the product of LJ and J. The concept evolutionary entropy is just sigma PJ log PJ, where PJ is VJ over R. This model describes a population with zero entropy. Why does it have zero entropy? It only has one reproductive opportunity at instant D. For this model, P1 is equal to 0, P2 is equal to 0, PD is 1. In the second model, S is positive. And annual plants and insects are typical of the S equals 0 model. Perennial plants and large mammals are typical of the S equals positive model. So this very simple concept allows me to classify plants and animals. The quantity entropy has three very important properties. It's an information measure. It describes the uncertainty in the age of the mother of a randomly chosen newborn. To see this, let us go back to this model. Let us consider a population with the S equals 0 condition. If we pick a newborn at random and ask, how old is your mother? We can predict that with probability 1 in the S equals 0 case. There's no uncertainty. We can't predict that with probability 1 in the S positive case. So this quantity S has a very clear-cut meaning. It also describes the rate at which a population returns to the steady state after a random perturbation. So it describes the stability of the population. And it's what I call a diversity measure. It's the diversity of energy flow within a population of organisms. To appreciate that, we just look at the S equals 0 case. There's just one pathway of energy flow. You proceed and you reproduce. Whereas in that case, there are multiple pathways of energy flow. There's energy flow from 2 to 1, 3 to 1, and D to 1. And in this case, it's just from D to 1. And the quantity S reflects that precisely. The theory based on entropy makes two classes of predictions. It distinguishes between equilibrium species, that is, species that spend most of their life history just fluctuating around a constant size. See, humans are somewhat like that. And, or large mammals. And it distinguishes between opportunistic species, species which undergo large variations in size. And mice are typical species of that type. And the theory predicts that equilibrium species on the evolutionary change will increase entropy. And opportunistic species, if the size is large, entropy will decrease, and if the size is small, the population size is small, entropy will behave randomly. Now, what does all this have to do with what I said earlier regarding metabolic rate and cycle time? The connection is that the entropy is linearly related to the logarithm of the metabolic rate, which is certainly not surprising, since you know that in physics, the entropy and temperature, there are linear relations between entropy and temperature. So it's not surprising that within this theory, there's going to be linear relationships between this entropy, which is a biological concept, and concepts like the physiological time. But given that relation, you can predict that for equilibrium species, which are perennials, there will be evolution to increase metabolic rate. So this theory predicts that if you just look at how the exponent changes, there will be evolution towards beta equals 1. And in the case of opportunistic species, evolution will act to minimize metabolic rate. So you tend towards the limiting case, the lower limit for these opportunistic species. So this model is quite distinct from the quantum metabolism model. The quantum metabolism model simply says that you will have different values of beta, the scaling exponent, depending on whether you are in the classical or in the quantum regime. This model predicts the class of species which you will find in the quantum regime and the class of species which you will find in the classical regime. It says that, in essence, that perennial class will be found in the classical regime where beta is equal to 1. And annual class will be found in the more or less quantum regime where beta is distinct from 1. So to conclude, we have some empirical rules. Let's just focus on metabolic rate. P equals alpha W beta. And as I said, to put this in the context with which you are familiar, think of the rule between heat capacity and temperature, or think of the rule relating take on the Stefan-Boltzmann law. We know the values for beta. We know how they range empirically. This is well established, as I said, by Kleiber and Rubner, and to some extent by Laplace and Lavoisier. And quantum metabolism says that we can explain these values. The explanation rests on the notion that energy is stored within the energy transducing membranes. They are driven by the vibrations of the proteins in these membranes. These phenomena is quantized. And given these assumptions, in the classical situation, we'll have 1. In the quantum situation, we'll have 3/4. 2/3 appears there because 2/3 is the minimum exponent for all the certain energetic constraints. directionality theory is quite different. It gives an adaptive explanation for these exponents. The first model doesn't explain why plants should have one, why perennial plants should have one, and why annual plants should have an exponent less than one. The directionality theory says that equilibrium species should have, if their plants should have beta equal to one. And opportunistic species should have large, small rate. So by integrating these two theories, one can come up with an understanding of these variations. So in this sense, we have a theory which is very, very different from the theories in physics. The theories in physics simply says under the classical regime, if you go back to Dulong and Petit and Einstein and Debye, you have scaling exponent 1 and you have scaling exponent 3. Various metals will fall within these ranges. There's no evolution because the changes from one type to another is not driven by any evolutionary process. In order to understand this variation, you need to go a little beyond the quantum formalism. You need to introduce an evolutionary scenario. And the evolutionary scenario will tell you why certain species have certain values and other species have other values. I've really gotten beyond my time, so I thank you for your attention.
A couple of quick questions. There have been other explanations of this of the scaling laws. West was one. Is one of them. There's sort of other people who have tried. Some of them are sort of much shorter, but they sort of can't make this kind of predictions that you can make. But they are shorter, and they also have this thing they can apply them to other systems, lower dimensional systems like rivers and stuff like that. So, are they just wrong, or are they complementary to your explanation?
Well, wrong is a very strong word. They differ in a very fundamental way. They differ in the sense that all those models which you described, West, are what one may call macroscopic models. They assume from the outset, for example, that metabolic rate satisfies the relation W to the beta. And the models have several weaknesses. One, the models are unable to explain the proportionality constants, which is very critical if you claim you have a general theory of metabolic activity. So it can't explain why birds live much longer than mammals of the same size. It can say nothing at all about these issues. And more seriously, the model cannot explain the fact that these scaling exponents also hold for unicells. The results about lifespan and metabolic rate spans all scales of biological organization. They apply to unicells, they apply to plants, they apply to animals. It's really fascinating because in biology you do not often see such universality. And the starting point of this approach is simply this. if this phenomenon is so universal and one wants a general explanation, one should begin with a phenomenon, one should begin with a situation that is common over all scales, over all biological organization. The only thing that's common is what the organisms do at the cellular level. In mitochondria, that does the are the energy transducing organelles for animals. Chloroplasts are the energy transducing organelles for plants. And in unicells, all the action goes on in the plasma membrane. So the strategy here is to begin with these very simple situations, to derive the scaling rules at that level, and then proceed to higher levels of organization. And by doing so, you can account for the whole gamut of behavior. You can't do this by a purely macroscopic approach. Just one other comment on that. To appreciate the weakness of the macroscopic model, you should actually go back to Boltzmann's attempt to explain Stefan Boltzmann's law. Boltzmann was able to account for the scaling exponent, but his model could not account for the proportionality constant. The proportionality constant in Boltzmann's work came out as just a constant in an integral. And this is why Planck decided to address this. He recognized that if you want to understand both the scaling, the proportionality constant and the scaling exponent, you need to look at the molecular details. So it is that perspective which influences the model I've described. Yes?
So in one of your data slides at the beginning, you have the scaling exponents for the different metabolic rates for the cardiac and, right. And respiratory and stuff like that. And they seem to, for example, you had the birds and the mouse, and they seem to kind of have very differently for the birds, and the exponents seem to vary differently for the birds and the mouse. And could that be explained if instead of taking W to be the mass of the whole animal, to actually take the mass of the system? So for the cardiac system, you take the mass of the heart, and stuff like that, and respiratory system. Does that help make the
Yes. In essence, if you actually look at these rules at the level of organs, you get slightly benefits. As soon as you move up the scale, you are integrating over a large space and a lot of other factors intervene, and you are not going to get either a precise quarter rule or a precise mean rule. Yes?
You mentioned that you might change the proton conductance of certain animals to change perhaps their lifespan. Could you change the cycle time for some animal and move it from, say, classical regime to a quantum regime, or is that something that's...
Well, the cycle time depends on the proton conductance, you see. What's given, what you start with at a cell, is the structure, the membrane determines what comes in and what gets out, and all the metabolic action goes up in the membrane. So you can manipulate the conductivity of the membrane by a variety of things, by diet, for example. It's known very well that organisms that exist in a vegetable diet have different phospholipid compositions than organisms that persist in the meat diet. So these factors do influence things. It could be that if you do not want to focus on evolutionary explanation, that certain birds differ from mammals because of diet. That certainly plays a role. Within the mammalian regime, a lot of the differences come from what they eat. And that suggests, in a way, that we may affect our lifespan simply by monitoring our food intake, not necessarily quantity, but in terms of quality or variety. Yes?
So do these same kinds of scaling laws hold for individuals of different size within a species?
Ooh, what do you mean? That?
Well, I mean, you know, so dogs, there's, you know, dogs.
I guess, yes, interesting, that's an interesting point. That's little, it's known very well that big dogs, it doesn't work within a species. And dogs are a very bad example because dogs have been domesticated, they have been on immense, very particular artificial selection. But it's a general rule that within that species, small dogs live much longer than big dogs.
What about particularly sized species within a genus?
Then the rule holds. Rule holds. It's a species-specific property. Maximum lifespan is a species-specific property. Maximum lifespan of humans is 120. That's a species-specific feature. And of Homo sapiens, if you go to Homo habilis or our ancestors, then about 60 or 70, that's pretty well established, and the scaling rule also holds. We don't know anything about the phospholipid composition of the membranes because the fossil record doesn't allow that, but we know that size and other features have changed.
I don't know how to phrase it, but how do you classify, for example, why some animals are cold-blooded and they can reduce their metabolism, for example, to one or two heartbeats per minute, and some can? So is there any relevance to this?
Well, there is a relevance, and things like the proton conductance is a function of the temperature. So is the proton motive force. Many organisms go into hibernation, and this is one way of extending their lifespan. The theory as it stands hasn't yet addressed these delicate issues. You must realize that there are a variety of complications in biology which you don't see in some sense in physics. There are so many different factors play a role. And what this model has done is to just focus on what goes on in the membrane and just focus on two parameters, the proton conductance and the proton motive force, and the body size. But there are other features in the equations which will affect the lifespan. And we have really very little empirical knowledge of. My objective is to say, well, with this very simple-minded start, if one makes predictions which seem consistent with the data, then this may indeed be a viable beginning.
I assume that people actually are able to measure the proton conductance of the cellular membranes of different species. How do the cellular, how do the membranes of humans compare with comparably massed birds and mammals like, say, dolphins or orangutans or ostriches or something? Because that, as you mentioned at the start, humans are exceptionally.
Humans are exceptional. Proton cost
several times longer than comparably massed mammals.
Yes.
The formulas you showed before.
There's data on that. In fact, there are people who have studied, made comparative studies of the proton conductance of birds, humans, and indeed, humans are somewhat off scale. They are much less than that of other.
As well, proton conductance.
Yes, yes. So that's been pretty well studied. And there's very there's some consensus, in fact, which gives me confidence in the model, that important content does play a very critical role in lifespan and metabolic rate. All these equations, they're making pretty sharp predictions, and one can test them, and if they fail, dismiss the model. So far, it seems to hold up.
Maybe many more questions that you might rather prefer to ask in private. So let's thank the speaker again for